Welcome to the weekend. I'm Angela Cocherga. Just ahead, an interview with University of Texas at El Paso President Heather Wilson. Her first academic year at the helm of UTEP began in August, when El Paso was in mourning following the Walmart mass shooting. In the spring, the COVID-19 pandemic forced universities to shut down and move to remote learning, and then the protests demanding justice for George Floyd. We covered a lot in our interview, including UTEP's legacy and future role in promoting racial equality and inclusiveness. But first, COVID-19 cases continue to climb across the state of Texas. Governor Greg Abbott on Friday ordered all bars closed at noon and scaled back restaurant capacity too. Houston Public Radio's Kyra Buckley reports from the city hardest hit by the COVID-19 spike here in Texas.
Bars and similar businesses have to stop in-person service, but can stay open for delivery and takeout. Restaurants may continue to offer dine-in. However, starting Monday, they can only operate at 50% capacity, down from 75%. Texas was one of the first states to begin reopening, and Houston has seen a sharp uptick in cases since June 1st. Harris County and the city of Houston are now reporting more than 17,300 active coronavirus cases, about 3,000 more than what was recorded earlier in the week. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Closer to home in rural West Texas, the concern was that visitors would help spread the virus. Early on, officials in the Big Bend region shuttered hotels and short-term rentals and enacted ordinances that limited residents and visitors from coming and going. Those early measures seem to have had an impact. For months, there were few COVID-19 cases. But now, after the state reopened, cases are beginning to add up. Carlos Morales of Marfa Public Radio reports from Big Bend National Park.
Just outside of Santa Elena Canyon in Big Bend National Park, I meet two visitors.
Matt Martin Lightfoot.
Katie Martin Lightfoot.
Visiting from Austin.
They say the whole drive over, they thought about what their presence might mean for a region that at that point had yet to be hit hard by the coronavirus.
We were talking about on the drive over here of bringing our, like, quote-unquote big city germs, like, into a more remote area.
The two are here during the first week of the park's reopening, and they say after a few months of working from home and little social interaction, they just needed a break. I mean, that's why I'm here. I've been feeling cooped up in Marfa and needed to get out, too.
This is probably the closest I've been to someone, actually, since we've been out here. No, you're fine. But, I mean, we brought our face masks with us, our hand sanitizers. So, like, the whole social distancing thing is definitely still something that we are very cautious of and doing.
And when you're here, Bob Krumenacker is strongly encouraging you to do all of those things. He's the superintendent at Big Bend National Park, and he says he's been agonizing over how to safely reopen the park, one of the region's largest draws for tourism. When we talk at a distance, he's wearing a mask, so he sounds a bit muffled.
There's no clear right and wrong here. In a lot of people's economic lives and most of all their health lives will be affected by the decision I make.
By Krumenacker's estimate, the park is further from medical care than any other national park in the lower 48. Even in normal times, he says getting medical help in the remote park is a challenge, but the pandemic has complicated it further.
4 hours of transport, however much time they have to be at the hospital, however much time it took to get to the patient and package them, and then when they're all back, they have to decontaminate everything.
For the entire 800,000-acre park, there's just one ambulance, and not many more across the region, too. And the hospital in Alpine the area relies on? 25 beds, 2 ICU beds, a handful of ventilators, and 0 medical specialists.
Yeah, this has probably been the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire career.
Across the Big Bend region, others are also grappling with reopening. For nearly 2 months, counties in far west Texas ordered hotels and Airbnbs to close. But they've been taking reservations again now for a while.
It's been stressful. It really has. I mean, being closed was stressful. How long is this going to last? What's going to happen to my staff?
Vicky Barge is the manager at the Hotel Paisano in Marfa.
And then reopening, same thing. How easy is this going to be? And again, what's going to happen to my staff?
Businesses across the region have focused their messaging on getting tourists to understand the local healthcare landscape. You'll see signs and social media posts that say, small town, no hospital, please wear a mask. For Barge, it's been difficult to manage the health and safety of her team while interacting with so many visitors.
I personally have heart disease. My partner that I live with has a compromised respiratory system. You know, I have a 9-month-old grandson, but I'm thinking, okay, I don't want to put them in jeopardy.
What Barge doesn't know, though, is in just a few days after we talk, new cases in the Big Bend region will be announced. They're vastly community spread, being traced back to businesses, a school district, and a state park. Alpine City Manager Eric Zimmer says there are still residents who just haven't taken the pandemic seriously.
Now, with new cases in the community, you've got this other group that was kind of along the sidelines wondering, is it going to hit us? So absolutely a heightened sense of concern.
As confirmed cases continue to climb, the impact of the coronavirus is now becoming less abstract. Dr. Ekta Escobar is the head of the region's COVID-19 task force. She says people should still stay home if possible and wear masks in public and continue to stay 6 feet apart in order to slow the spread of the virus.
This is not the place to get sick. This is not the place where we want a lot of our community getting sick with COVID, because our limited healthcare system won't be able to handle a large influx of patient volume locally.
From the outside, the Big Bend region seems like the perfect place to be during a pandemic. The towns are spread out and sparsely populated too. But that feeling of safety hinges on there being few COVID-19 cases here. If the disease continues to spread and strains the region's one hospital, then the area can quickly become one of the scariest places to be. I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa.
And now our conversation with UTEP President Dr. Heather Wilson, which was done via Zoom.
How are you? I mean, you've just completed your first academic year at the helm of UTEP, and it's been quite the year. I mean, you took over during the mass shooting. The people were still mourning that mass shooting at Walmart. Then we had the pandemic this spring. And of course, right now, the George Floyd protests. So how are you? And how are you?
I am doing just great.
What are your thoughts?
We're doing fine. We're all healthy. This was not what any of us expected this year. So I think we'll all be glad when 2021 comes, but we're doing just fine.
That's good. I mean, looking back at this first academic year, what are your thoughts? And we can take these issues in order, but I know you put out a very thoughtful statement about what was happening with the George Floyd protests and UTEP's proud legacy of breaking down barriers. Can I ask you to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is a wonderful legacy here, but I decided that I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking to our students and faculty and staff, which I did last Monday and Tuesday in just small groups outside on the patio next to the alumni building, to just get a sense of whether we had a problem here on campus and in El Paso. And I felt as though I wanted to do that, and then just to listen to them on their ideas for how we might make some things better.
And in your statement, I mean, you really outlined some of those. Everyone's well aware of the 1966 NCAA basketball championship, but there are other examples. I mean, you noted that UTEP was the first baccalaureate institute of higher learning to desegregate in Texas.
I think that's true, but there's even a more interesting piece of that story. The student who was the first Black student here at UTEP graduated from a segregated high school here in El Paso, and she applied and was declined admission, and then she went to, at that time, New Mexico A&M, which is now New Mexico State, and then she reapplied with the support and challenged in court with the support of the NAACP, and the lawyer who represented her to desegregate Texas Western at the time was Thurgood Marshall, who then went on, of course, to be on the Supreme Court of the United States. And you just think about that. It's just an amazing, and so that happened in the 1950s. And then one of those first students that the NAACP helped to enroll here at Texas Western at the time, or at UTEP, was a singer, and it was quite controversial at the time. One of our music faculty cast her as the female lead in an opera, opposite a white male lead. So there is, this university has been breaking down barriers from its very early days. It was the first university in Texas to hire a faculty member who is Hispanic. So we've got a legacy here. And we have a student body that is over 90% minority at a class one research university. And we should be proud of who we are and live up to our own legacy.
All good points. And that outreach to students during this critical time was good to hear their feedback. Moving on to the pandemic, that's the other big thing that's still happening. I mean, the virus has not disappeared, even though we do see people out marching in the streets. And we're all trying to get back to normal life little by little. But UTEP, I mean, in the spring, had to adapt quickly to remote learning and really figure out how to handle this and still provide the rest of the semester an education for students who are attending the university. How did that work out?
The faculty just was amazing in shifting the entire university online within like 10 days. I mean, if we had planned that for 2 years, it wouldn't have been enough time. And yet when we had to, they found a way and everybody helped each other. And it was certainly an exhausting semester for everyone. Some of our younger faculty or more technologically oriented faculty helped a lot of us who have a little more gray hair. And I I think probably before this whole thing happened, I had used Zoom once and never really, cotton to it. And now I use it several times a day at about 8 other computer programs that none of us knew about before we had to do this. So there's been a lot of learning going on among not just the students, but faculty and staff.
Oh, well, I'm with you. I had not done a Zoom either before this. So we are learning as we go. I've been very inspired by some of our students who especially have remained out in the community as essential workers as they were also balancing remote learning and trying to figure things out. The university also moved to quickly try and figure out ways to help those students. Talk to me a little bit about that. Some that who were struggling economically, some who just had to figure out how they were going to get by.
Well, it's economically, but it was also, and I give tremendous credit to our financial aid folks in student affairs. You know, we've got students who don't have a laptop or Wi-Fi at home. And in that 10-day period over spring break and the week following, they figured out how to get technology grants to get a tablet or a laptop in the hands of over 2,000 students who wouldn't have otherwise been able to continue their education. And likewise, our IT folks and the folks who design courses online just really put in huge amounts of hours to help to shift and teach other faculty members. So it was just an amazing effort. With the CARES Act funds, that allowed us to provide financial grants to students who were in circumstances that none of them anticipated. And some of them have lost their jobs. Some of them were having trouble paying rent or buying food. And we set up a very simple system that we could operate over the internet to be able to get applications and payments out to students very quickly.
Yeah, no, that a huge help. And I know one of the students that was able to get that laptop, and that made a huge difference in her being able to finish the semester and her coursework. Let me ask you about the university's role in the city's pandemic response. I mean, UTEP really has played a role in trying to ramp up this testing, both with equipment and with highly trained university staff members. Talk to me a little bit about that.
We have. This is a university that is desperately needed in the region that we serve. And one of the things that we do here is teach clinical laboratory science. And very shortly after this started, when the city laboratory was going to have to stay open longer hours and 6 days a week, they don't have the staff for that. And so most of those staff at the City Lab are our alumni. And one of them called back to one of their professors and said, do you think you can help? They, of course, contacted the dean and the provost and I, and we worked with the city to get a very quickly get an agreement for our faculty members to be able to work at the City Lab and take extra shifts. Then the city asked us in early April, do you think you could expand the testing? So it's not going out and taking the samples from people at the drive-thrus and the parking lots. It is the taking those samples and finding out whether there is COVID-19 in them. We have expertise in genetics. We do research on machines here that can do that work. They weren't FDA-approved machines, so we actually had to get some additional machines so that we could do FDA-approved diagnoses, but it took us about 3.5 weeks to get those machines, get them set up and calibrated, finished an agreement with the city. The real advantage of this is to get the results back quickly. So we can do a test and get it back in 24 hours, whereas some of the drive-throughs and that have been set up by these corporate labs, which are great, have to send the sample to Austin or California, and they're really backed up. So we hope that this helps the city get timely results from COVID tests.
You know, really, really essential, especially as we open up and move forward. And looking about opening up, the next fall is going to be different. It won't be totally shut down like the spring, but what do you envision in the fall? And I also want to ask you about, you were the only university president in Texas on a call with Vice President Mike Pence to talk about reopening institutions of higher learning. So what would you want to say about that?
Well, with respect to reopening, in the fall, we teach over 4,300 different sections. So over 4,300 different sections is what we teach. Now, all those were set up before the pandemic, and we had students registering for classes. Now we've gone back to the faculty and surveyed also the students to say, okay, in the fall, do you want to be in person, by distance, some hybrid? How would you like to design this? So we got a whole lot of information. We're now redoing the schedule like a 4,300 piece jigsaw puzzle. And we hope to have a revised schedule that will probably have, will certainly have more distance enabled and hybrid classes than we initially envisioned. But all of this is intended to try to meet the needs of the students in a pandemic. Any classes that we do have on campus will have to be socially distanced. So you might have been able to fit 30 students in a class before. It may be 15 students now. So every location and classroom on campus, we have measured out and looked at what its capacity can be.
As far as dorms, I know students had to move off campus when there was a real concern about the virus spreading. Will those be back to normal? Obviously not totally normal, but will people be able to live in the dorms?
Yes, in fact, we've still had over 50 students who continued to live in the dorms, who had some of them international students who couldn't get home, some of them who are students who have no place else to live. They live in the dorms. They don't have a home to go to. And so that has continued in the fall and even over the summer with our athletes. They will be coming back to the dorms. We are following best practices for the Centers for Disease Control. We may have fewer, some rooms may not be big enough to have as many students as we had in them last year, but we will have the dorms open.
And getting back to that call with the Vice President, will there be more communication or more planning kind of on a national level on how best to do this, or was that kind of a one-time meeting?
Well, I was very happy to participate in it. My message really had to do with the role of higher education in helping our economy recover. Education has always been the pathway to a better life in America. And it is also an engine for economic growth and recovery. And I believe that that's the appropriate role for higher education, and we have to protect that as we come back and operate. So I do think that, and I kudos to the UT system and our chancellor, they haven't tried to micromanage our return to campus. That would be, our campuses are also different. Even on this campus, we figured out, our return to campus team figured out pretty early on that there is no way to create some one size fits all set of rules for how to come back to campus. The physical plant people who are running the water treatment facility have a completely different circumstance than somebody down in mechanical engineering or in a history class or a musical performance class. So we had to give some guide rails and guidelines, and then say to every leader on campus who was responsible for people and getting stuff done, come up with your own short returns to work safety plan. And it's got some things you got to have in it that you got to think about, but think about it and then lead your team back.
So what, as you look ahead to the fall, what worries you most, or how will you keep a handle on the virus, and kind of what could happen? The test device or contact tracing, or what are your thoughts?
We teach contact tracing here as part of our public health program. And so we're providing a service to the people of West Texas, and they are great part-time flex place, flex time jobs for students, particularly in things like social work. So there are a lot of things we're getting done. I think balancing the need for students to continue their education while keeping everyone as safe as possible will be the biggest issue this fall. And I think this is possible to do, but we're going to be driven, as you would expect for a university, by the science and the public health guidance.
And looking ahead, I mean, you're right about the university being an economic driver, especially in our region. And I've heard you talk about this, your vision, promoting innovation, technology, even startups. Talk a little bit about that, because that's still in the works. Things have been overshadowed by the pandemic, but that's clearly one of your big goals.
Well, it's one of the things that we do. I think we have a lot of little efforts on campus related to innovation and entrepreneurship. But when we come out of this, 40 million people have lost their jobs. Some of those jobs will not come back. And so small business leaders around this community are going to have to think about new markets and new customers and serving them in new ways and creating new kinds of jobs. And as an institution of higher education, we have to be there for them and help them through that process of learning, because they're going to be learning to do new things. And that's why we're here. That's part of our mission.
And I asked you about what worries you, but what gives you hope as you look ahead, especially during these very difficult times?
This is a wonderful university, and my interactions with faculty, staff, and students are always uplifting. And there it's very rare that you walk into somebody who's just looking at their shoes and dispirited. This is a really strong and resilient community. And it shows in our students and in the faculty and staff. There is a deep commitment to this university and our mission. And you can't beat that. You just can't beat that.
And a couple final questions. I mean, I also would like to hear your impressions about El Paso, having lived here now for a while. And also this idea, you've been in Washington, and how, the border, the perception of the border and the reality. What do you think, what would be your message to people who don't know the city, don't know this borderland region?
Jay and I are really happy to be back in the Southwest. I have to say, one of the best things about being back here was we didn't have a bad meal for like 6 months. And now we've been, 10 weeks living at home. The good thing is my husband cooks well, so I'm still doing okay, but I'm looking forward to the restaurants being back open and being able to enjoy that again. And so the fact that we're really close to Hatch Green Chili is something to really like about being back in the Southwest. As for people's perceptions about El Paso is the fifth safest city in America. I don't think a lot of people outside of Texas know that. And it is also a place of trade, five bridges with, you know, in normal times, 10,000 people a day, I think, crossing those bridges, 100 billion in commerce. I mean, it is the fourth most intense manufacturing region in all of North America. So I think there are a lot of things about El Paso and this region that are not known by people who've never visited here. And so it's too much of a well-kept secret, and we need to fix that a little bit.
I know the university is doing its part to get that message out. Well, Dr. Wilson, is there anything else that I didn't ask you that you really want to emphasize as far as what's the last few months, really?
Well, I think one of the things, we have our athletes coming back. We're planning for the fall athletic sessions, and right now planning to have all of our games in person, and I think it's the 5th of September is the opener against Texas Tech in the football stadium, and so I think people are looking. I've been in touch with student government as well. The opening of school and that first week of excitement being back won't be quite the same, but we're going to try to do things that are different, but also still engaging, particularly for our freshman class, so that they make that adjustment to being college students and get on the track very early towards success.
Yeah, and commencement will happen in the fall as well.
We will have a commencement on Saturday evening, the 12th of September, for the students who would have graduated in May. And then, of course, we'll have another commencement in December. So we'll be all over commencements in the fall.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Wilson, for your time and for bringing us up to date and also looking ahead.
Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you in person sometime in the fall when we get back to campus.
Likewise.
Before we go, we continue our salute to high school graduates with messages from notable El Pasoans. F. Murray Abrams is an Academy Award-winning actor. He's also won awards for his theater and television work, including his leading role on the Emmy Award-winning series Homeland that aired on Showtime.
Hello, everyone. First of all, congratulations to all of you. It doesn't matter to me if you're at the top half or the bottom half of the class. You are all equal. You are all graduates, and you should be proud. I'm proud of you. I don't even know you, but I'm proud of you because it's a great accomplishment. When people in your family or friends congratulate you, be gracious. Say thank you. Because remember, some of them will never achieve a high school diploma. So it's a big deal. Don't brush it off. I wish that I had thanked some of my teachers. I wasn't a very good student. I was in the bottom half, way the bottom half of the class. But one teacher, Lucia P. Hutchins, introduced me to my life. And I owe her and other teachers there who had faith in me, in spite of what a crazy kid I was. They had faith in me. And I'd like to thank them all now. And I wish you would consider doing the same thing. I had a very good fortune of growing up in El Paso when the border was much more open than it is now. Most of my friends were Mexican, and they had families in Juarez, and I had access to their homes. I was welcome there. I grew up speaking Spanish. I feel like part of my soul is Mexican. I hope one day that the border will again be as free as it was then. This is a tough time. We are all aware of that, but we are all in this together, and we are relying on you to help us out of this mess. The future is yours. We haven't done too much of a good deal with it, but now it's up to you. You can do it. Do the best you can. You cannot do more than that. Bless you all. I'll see you in the movies.
Thank you to El Paso Matters, Barracuda PR, and the El Paso Community Foundation for producing The Salute to the Class of 2020. Thanks to our audio engineer, Sam Cassiano, and thank you for listening to another edition of The Weekend. I'm Angela Cocherga.